since we only meet a couple times a month, generally speaking, and we've taken a few breaks here and there, but a lengthy study we have done on the book of Judges. And I don't want to get, let me put it this way. If you're coming in on the tail end of this, there'll be a lot of things here that may not make as much sense to you as hopefully they would otherwise. I will try to answer some of those questions that might arise as we go. But the book of Judges comes to a somewhat, it's a hopeful ending, but also in some ways a kind of anticlimactic ending. When we started out on the book of Judges, I said that Judges is basically R-rated gospel stories. And I stand by that because it is, in fact, I just saw, somebody sent me this today. It's a guy who's doing, it's like one of these little short videos, and it's a guy who's doing his, it says at the bottom, like, you know, when your Bible reading plan gets to Judges, and you can like see his eyes get really big and stuff as he's reading different things or getting out popcorn at one point. And Judges is kind of that way because it is full of some very, we'll just say, spicy stories. And that's especially true when you get to the end. Lots of violence, lots of sex, lots of gore, lots of sin that you see in this book. And so we've been working through that in these final passages. At the same time, as dark as it seems in a lot of ways, if you look particularly at Hebrews chapter 11, Hebrews chapter 11 speaks of the judges in general in very favorable terms as men of faith. And so the judges are faithful examples in many ways, and we should read them positively. We should probably read the book positively as often as we can if there's ambiguity. But there are also some things that are obviously just plain wrong. Where Israel is very clearly in sin, or in the case of the last few chapters here, where the tribe of Benjamin is in sin. In fact, does somebody want to review for us really quickly what we've seen in chapters 19 and 20 before we get into 21? Maybe somebody who's been here, if you can think back to what we saw in chapters 19 and 20. Chapter 19, you've got a Levite who's got a concubine, which is like a wife without a dowry, and she runs away from him. He pursues her as they're making their journey back after staying at her father's house for a while. They end up staying at Gibeah, and what happens in Gibeah, which is in the tribe of tribal territory of Benjamin.
The people from Gibeah, all these men come up and pound on the door and try and get the master of the house to turn over the guy that's staying with them so that they can rape him. Gross. And then the master of the house says, "No, I'm not going to do that, but you can have his concubine that he just went all this work to chase down." And they eventually kill her. Over the course of the night.
They rape her and kill her, and then she's dead the next morning. Yeah, okay. So when I say it's a dark story, that's it. So then what does the Levite do after this?
He cuts her up and sends her pieces to the 12 tribes.
Yeah, he cuts up her corpse, sends the pieces of her corpse out to the 12 tribes, and basically says, "You must come and avenge my concubine. You must go to war with the tribe of Benjamin." The city of Gibeah, which is part of Benjamin, basically leads the whole tribe into this sin. The other members of Benjamin who don't live in Gibeah decide it's more important for us to side with our own than to side with the Lord. So they put, you could say, blood above the covenant. And so they're going to defend their own. And so now you've got this basically a civil war within Israel where the other 11 tribes are taking on Benjamin. Okay, so that's the next situation. This is what we looked at last time in chapter 20. What happens with this civil war between the other 11 tribes and Benjamin? Anybody remember?
They go out and fight. The Benjamites drive them back. They go out and fight. The Benjamites drive them back. And then they finally actually like pray to God, ask for his blessing on it. And he says that they will be victorious, so they draw them out of the city, ambush them, kill them, go in and destroy the city, or kill everyone in the city. got justice.
Yeah, yeah, lot of bloodshed there. So the whole tribe of Benjamin is basically wiped out. It doesn't happen on the first try, it doesn't happen on the second try, but on the third try, after they've worshipped the Lord, which is so often the turning point in these stories, we'll see that again in chapter 21, they're able to go to war with Benjamin and get the victory. And the tribe of Benjamin is almost completely exterminated. Think about this. One of the 12 tribes of Israel almost completely wiped out of existence, except for at the end of chapter 20, we find that there were 600 men of Benjamin left. Now, this is what's interesting. We'll read chapter 1 here in just a minute, but this is what's interesting. I'll break it up into sections and start to read it. The nation of Israel has nearly lost one of its tribes, and you'll actually see in verses 3, 6, and 15 how the other 11 tribes actually mourn over this, which seems really strange. It's like they've gone to war with Benjamin for what seems like a very justified reason, to avenge the death of the concubine, this Levite's bride, to carry out justice. The Benjamites, this is how you should understand it. The Benjamites, when the people of Gibeah raped and murdered, they were acting like the people of Sodom. And so they get the Sodom treatment. Remember, God brought judgment on Sodom. He's going to bring judgment on the people of Gibeah. Or think of it this way. They're acting like Canaanites, so they get the Canaanite treatment. So if you act like Canaanites, you're going to be judged like Canaanites. And so just as the Israelites were to wipe out the Canaanites, the Israelites are now going to wipe out the Benjamites because they've become Canaanites. Not only do they go to war with them, but they also pledge, as we'll see in this chapter, that they will not give any of their daughters to marry a Benjamite. Okay, that's going to become really important in this chapter. So the Benjamites are like, they're like the men of Sodom, they're like the Canaanites, and so they've received the same kind of judgment. The rest of Israel becomes an instrument of God's judgment against this tribe that obviously has become very, very wicked. They almost completely exterminate the tribe of Benjamin, and as soon as they do it, it's almost like they regret it, they grieve it. They realize, oh no, one of the tribes is about to go extinct. And then they ask, well, okay, is there any way that we can preserve the tribe? Is there any way that we can, if Benjamin is nearly dead, is there any way that we can resurrect the tribe of Benjamin? This will be like a death and resurrection for the tribe of Benjamin. And it's interesting, what happened in Gibeah with the Levite's concubine really becomes a kind of paradigm for evil in the nation of Israel. So like if you fast forward several centuries into the future to the time of the prophet Hosea uses what happened in Gibeah in Judges chapter 20 as a paradigm, well really Judges chapter 19, as a paradigm for Israel's apostasy in his day. So in Hosea chapter 9 and chapter 10, you see that. It's like this is a stain on the memory of Israel. It's a stain on the nation of Israel, and it becomes this paradigm for apostasy within Israel. But as soon as they've carried out judgment, there's a sense in which they grieve over it, and they look for some way to redeem the tribe of Benjamin that does not violate the oaths and vows that they have made. So, for example, they made a vow to not give any of their own daughters to the tribe of Benjamin. But if the tribe of Benjamin is going to survive, they've got to have wives. So you've got to rebuild the nation out of these mere 600 men that are left. So you've got to find wives for them. So that's really what chapter 21 is about, is it's about, just at a surface level, it's about finding wives for the remaining men of Benjamin. At a deeper level, it's about the death and resurrection of this tribe, and it's about God's mercy being mixed with his justice, or you could say God's mercy in a way even overcoming his justice, okay? So let's read the first section of this. Somebody want to read for us Judges 21, verses 1 to 9.
Hi, Dave.
Go ahead for us.
All right. Now the men of Israel had sworn an oath at Mizpah, saying, "None of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin as a wife." Then the people came to the house of God, and remained there before God till evening. They lifted up their voices and wept bitterly and said, "O Lord God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel, that today there should be one tribe missing in Israel?" So it was on the next morning that the people rose early and built an altar there and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. The children of Israel said, Who is there among all the tribes of Israel who did not come up with the assembly to the Lord? For they had made a great oath concerning anyone who had not come up to the Lord at Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. And the children of Israel grieved for Benjamin, their brother, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives for those who remain, seeing we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them our daughters as wives? And they said, what one is there from the tribes of Israel who did not come up to Mizpah to the Lord? And in fact, no one had come up to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. For when the people were counted, indeed, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so a lot of this is what I just summarized for you. Verse 1, as they realize that one of their own tribes is nearly extinct, they want to rebuild the tribe of Benjamin. But how can they do that when they have vowed to not give their own daughters to the men of Benjamin as wives? You can't, just like you couldn't intermarry with the Canaanites, they made a vow, we're not going to intermarry with the Benjamites. But I and we'll come to this in a minute. I think at this point in the story, we can say that the tribe of Benjamin, the remaining members of the tribe of Benjamin, do repent. And so that cancels out or mitigates the judgment, but it doesn't undo their oath, which is still binding. So they can't give their own daughters to marry the Benjamites. They've got to devise a plan. They've got to come up with a way of solving this problem. If we're going to rebuild the tribe of Benjamin, we have to find the wives. How can we do that when we said we wouldn't give our own wives? In verses, our own daughters for wives for the remaining men. Verses 2 and 3, you see they go to the house of God. So they gather for worship. They lift up their voices and they weep bitterly. Now, I don't think this means they regret what they did in bringing judgment against the Benjamites. What might this mean? Why would they be weeping bitterly? How should we understand their emotions here when on the one hand, they were obviously instruments of God's judgment in going to war with Benjamin, and God blessed them and ultimately gave them this victory over Benjamin, but now we see them weeping over it. How do we make sense out of that? I mean, it seems like at the very moment that they win this war, they, in a sense, grieve over their own success. How do we make sense out of that?
It's tragic, like a civil war is, like you're victorious, but you just killed those who are closest to you. And so, would that be it? I mean, it's just multiple times that they grieved over the fact that they were simply made and extinct. And so, and how that is not a good thing. One of them, essentially.
Close kinship.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. He said kinship. Oh, yeah. I think that's a good way to think about it. I think there are a lot of situations where there is something that has to be done, and it's righteous to do it, and there's a sense in which we should always delight in doing what is right, and yet we can also, in a sense, grieve over it because of the sin that occasioned it. So think about if you're a civil magistrate, and there's somebody who has done something that is worthy of death, and so they have to be executed. You might know that this is a form of justice that has to be administered, and yet grieve over the fact that a life is going to be terminated. Or if you're, maybe an example that hits closer to home, if you're a parent who has to discipline a child, on the one hand, you know it has to be done, and you delight in doing what is right, but at the same time, you know, it's like the old line parents use, this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you. Okay, yeah, some of you parents, you know, you're kind of grieved over that. So even though you're administering justice in a sense, there's also a sense in which you are grieving over the fact that it has to be administered in this particular way. Or actually the one that I think hits home the most is when pastors and elders in a church have to do an excommunication. You have somebody who's no longer walking with the Lord. They've been a church member, but they're clearly not living as a Christian anymore. Jesus and elsewhere in scripture, we find a church discipline process. You start to carry that process out and you get to the point where you have to excommunicate somebody. You have to remove them from the body of Christ, put them out of communion or put them out of fellowship. And on the one hand, you recognize this is something righteous that has to be done. And at the same time, you grieve over the fact that it has to be done. And I think that's what the other 11 tribes of Israel are doing here. You can tell when Paul in 1 Corinthians basically tells the Corinthians that they've got a church discipline situation that's gone unaddressed, and they've got a man who's committing grievous sexual sin who has to be excommunicated. You can tell on the one hand that Paul is sees this as necessary. It has to be done, and you can also see where Paul, in a sense, grieves over the fact that it's come to this. And I think that's really where the tribes of Israel are here. They did the right thing. They were instruments of God's justice in doing this, and yet they recognize that there's a sense in which this is really, really sad that it had to happen this way. And so now the question for them is, can we find a way to save Benjamin that does not compromise justice or break the vows we have made? Okay, so that's really their dilemma. They want to save Benjamin. They want to have compassion on Benjamin. But how can they do that without compromising justice? And how can they do that without breaking vows they have made, such as the vow that they will not give any of their own daughters to be wives to the remaining men of Benjamin? So it's interesting. If you go back and look, originally the plan was to completely annihilate the Benjamites. And obviously they didn't do that. If you look back at chapter 20, verse 47, you see that there were 600 men of Benjamin who survived, who basically hid out in a cave, and that's how they were able to survive. Can you think of other examples where it seems like destruction is decreed, and yet then mercy in some way is shown? Other examples of this in the Bible?
The flood.
Okay. The flood. God's going to wipe out all flesh and then saves one family, Noah's family. What's another example?
The Garden of Eden.
Okay, Garden of Eden, on this day you'll die, and yet they don't. There's mercy shown.
And Sodom and Gomorrah as well.
Okay, Lot is able to flee the city. Mm-hmm. Yeah, didn't make it out with his wife, but he did make it out with his daughters, yes. One that comes to my mind is Jonah, when he's told to go to Nineveh. God has determined to destroy Nineveh, but he's going to send a prophet there to preach. And so Jonah goes and announces judgment, and when he does so, the people of Nineveh repent, and so the city is spared. Which doesn't mean God changed his decree. It doesn't mean God changed his eternal plan, but it means that God's plan all along was to give Nineveh the opportunity to repent, and if they did, he would relent. In fact, if you look at Jeremiah 18, you see this is what God always does. Jeremiah 18, God says to the prophet, if I announce judgment against a particular city or nation, and that city or nation then repents, then I will relent in my judgment. And he says, if I announce blessing to a particular city or nation, and they turn away from me, then I will relent in the good that I had determined to do, and instead will bring judgment against them. So you've got examples like this. Another one that comes to mind is in the book of Exodus with the golden calf, where God is determined to destroy all of Israel and start out with Moses. Moses intercedes for them, and then God spares the nation. Okay, all of these are examples where there's justice tempered by mercy, in a sense. And that's what I think you have here. I think you have justice mixed with mercy, or justice tempered with mercy, with compassion. Verse 4, they offer sacrifices. And as I said, when you see a worship service like this, it often seems to be the turning point in a story like this. It talks about here how they offered in verse 4 burnt offerings, that's more literally ascension offerings, and peace offerings. Those are the offerings where you get to eat from the Lord's table. It's like a communion meal. So this is a worship service. This is a feast that they have before the Lord in the Lord's presence. And my guess is that here they are interceding for Benjamin. That's part of what they do here, is that when they have this worship service, this is like a prayer service where they are gathered to pray for Benjamin. And so that's what you're going to see in the rest of this story, is the Lord answering their prayer that Benjamin would be spared. Because immediately after that, in verse 5, you see they begin to devise a plan. And what is that plan in verse 5? They remember another oath that they had made. Basically, it's if anybody doesn't join in the war effort. So when the 12 pieces were sent out and the tribes were summoned to come fight against Benjamin, they took an oath that any people who did not respond to that, any people who did not come out to avenge the death of the priest's bride, that they would go to war against them next. It's kind of like if there's an excommunication and then you side with the person who got excommunicated. Okay, or if there's just discipline carried out or just punishment given, and you side with the person who got punished or disciplined. I mean, that's basically what this is. So it shows that you're on the wrong side, that you're not willing to carry out the Lord's justice. In fact, it's interesting. If you go back to Deuteronomy, to the Torah, in Deuteronomy chapter 17, when someone was to be executed by stoning in the Torah, that's I think part of the background for this, God says all the people are to be involved in casting the stones. It's like a corporate judgment. You all are involved in it. You're all expressing agreement with it in a way. Obviously, that's you have a really hard time ever getting people to sign on to that kind of thing today because we're kind of soft compared to that. But but that's the thing. It's like justice must be done, and we want the whole community to sign off on this justice, to be a part of it. And so you go look at Deuteronomy 17:7. That's what it says. That's the principle. Church discipline or civil discipline, however you want to understand that in that context, everybody's going to be involved in it. And that's the idea here, that if you're a holdout, maybe it means you're a coward. Or if you're a holdout, maybe it means that you disagree and you're actually siding with the perpetrators of this wickedness. If you're a holdout, it means you're not sharing in the judgment that you're called to be a part of as members of the nation of Israel. It calls into question, whose side are you really on? And of course, what they recall is that the city of Jabesh-Gilead, okay, so don't confuse Gibeah with Jabesh-Gilead. Gibeah is the city where the concubine was raped and murdered. Now you've got Jabesh-Gilead that refused to send anybody to go fight against Gibeah and the people of Benjamin. And so for that reason, Jabesh-Gilead now must be destroyed. So let's read verses 10 to 15. Somebody want to read that for us?
I'll read it.
Go ahead.
So the congregation sent 12,000 of their bravest men there and commanded them, "Go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, also the women and the little ones. This is what you shall do. Every male and every woman that has lain with a male, you shall devote to destruction." And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him. And they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin, who were at the rock of Rimmon, and proclaimed peace to them. And Benjamin returned at the time, and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead. But they were not enough for them, and the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel.
Okay, great. Okay, so verses 10 to 12, they go to strike Jabesh-Gilead. They kill everyone in the city except for who? 400 young unmarried women. Yeah, which obviously this was the plan. They do not... As they wipe out the town of Jabesh-Gilead, they spare these young marriageable women so that they can be brides for the Benjamites. Okay, so again, Benjamin needs wives or Benjamin will go extinct. These 400 women will be wives for some of the survivors of Benjamin. One thing I will just go ahead and mention here is this is not necessarily a recipe for how to find a wife or how to find a husband. Okay, if you're wondering about that, I'll just go ahead and state that. No more than what you see in the next book of the Bible, the way Ruth goes about it. The way she goes about it is righteous, but it's just not a model in any kind of way. And I'd say the same thing here. Now, remember, there were 600 men of Benjamin, 600 Benjamite bachelors, okay, who were spared. Now we've got 400 of the women. So you talk about a matchmaking service, okay? So, here it is. So 400 of the 600 will now have wives. They actually send a word of peace to Benjamin in verse, what is it, verse 13. It's kind of like sending a word of peace saying, hey, we have found wives for a bunch of your men, okay? And again, I think we can assume at this point that these Benjamite survivors are repentant of what they were involved in earlier. So we've got 400 of the 600 cared for, but there are still 200 men who don't have wives. So it's interesting, verse 15, it talks about how they're still grieving for Benjamin. And again, how should you understand this grief? This would be like the grief over someone who has been excommunicated and you're longing for their restoration. Okay, that's the kind of grief. And that's what's happening is the excommunicated tribe is being restored, but it's still not fully restored. And so there's still grief. Some of the tribe is being restored by these 400 women that have been found to be husbands, to be wives for their men. But it's still not complete. The restoration process is still not complete. So let's read verses 16 to 25. Anyone want to read that for us?
I can do it.
Okay.
16 to 25.
16 to 25. Yeah, we'll just finish it out.
And the elders of the assembly said, "With the women of Benjamin destroyed, how shall we provide wives for the men who are left? The Benjaminite survivors must have heirs." They said, so that a tribe of Israel will not be wiped out. "We can't give them our daughters as wives, since we Israelites have taken this oath. Cursed be anyone who gives a wife to a Benjaminite. But look, there is the annual festival of the Lord in Shiloh, which lies north of Bethel, east of the road that goes from Bethel to Shechem, and south of Labona. So they instructed the Benjamites, saying, 'Go and hide in the vineyards and watch. When the young women of Shiloh come out to join in the dancing, rush from the vineyards, and each of you seize one of them to be your wife. Then return to the land of Benjamin. When their fathers or brothers complain to us, we will say to them, do us the favor of helping them, because we did not get wives for them during the war. You will not be guilty of breaking your oath, because you did not give your daughters to them.' So that is what the Benjamites did. While the young women were dancing, each man caught one and carried her off to be his wife. Then they returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and settled in them. And that time the Israelites left that place. And went home to their tribes and clans, each to his own inheritance. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit."
Okay. Thank you for reading that. So we're looking here for more wives for the men of Benjamin, and they want to do so again without breaking their vow. What's their clever solution to this problem?
7 brides for 7 brothers.
Something like that, yes.
400 brides for 600.
Yeah. So there's this yearly festival. Now, if you look at this in verse 19, it mentions this feast of the Lord. So presumably there was nothing sinful involved, or I don't think it would be described that way, this feast of the Lord in Shiloh. But it's interesting. We know nothing else about this feast. There's obviously nothing about this is not prescribed in any kind of way in the Torah. There's nothing that I know of about this anywhere else in the entire Old Testament. So it seems to be a rather unique kind of thing. But remember, they have said, we're not going to give our daughters to be sons to the men of Benjamin. But there's nothing in the vow or oath that they took that says the men of Benjamin can't catch their own wives. Okay, so that's their way around the vow. So basically, they concoct a plan, and they tell the bachelors of Benjamin, the 200 remaining who need wives, what to do. Basically, when these girls come out to do their husband-catching dance, don't use your imagination. When the girls, this again is not, I'm not saying this is how you find a spouse. I don't think that's what the story is about. But when the girls come out to do their husband-catching dance, so to speak, the men are to go up and grab one of these girls for themselves, and they will be married. I'm sure there was a little bit more to it. In the modern world, this would raise all kinds of questions about, it's just interesting, modern commentaries will raise all kinds of questions about, is this consent? Is this consensual? Is this rape? What is this? I think it's impossible to think of this as something that involves rape or that is not consensual. The whole reason they went to war with Benjamin in the first place was rape. Okay, so they knew that was wrong. They're not repeating that sin here. Okay, so whatever kind of details are not included in the story, we shouldn't make this sound worse than what it was. Okay, it appears that everybody understood that this was I wouldn't call it a mating ritual, but I mean, it was an acceptable kind of thing to do in that context. And the girls were doing this because they wanted to be found. They wanted to be caught by a man. And get married. So they go ahead with this plan, and the remaining men of Benjamin get their wives. And then what do you see in verses 23 and 24? Verse 22 is kind of their defense as to how this was a legitimate plan, not something anybody can complain about. And then what do you see in verses 23 and 24?
Everybody's going home to their families.
Yeah. The tribe of Benjamin has been saved. They've got enough wives now that the tribe can begin to reproduce itself and be preserved. They can reclaim their inheritance. They can rebuild their cities that were destroyed in the Civil War. And so there was this grieving over what had happened with Benjamin. And now it's like there is this rejoicing. There's this, it ends with this sign of hope for the tribe of Benjamin, that the tribe of Benjamin has been saved and restored and set right. This is a story of grace overcoming judgment. Benjamin was rightly and justly judged and now is graciously and mercifully restored. It is a death and resurrection for the tribe of Benjamin. They were in sin. They were punished for their sin. And now they've been brought back to life. Now they've been restored. Now they've been able to reclaim their inheritance that had been forfeited earlier. Okay, so it is a story of restoration and a story of redemption. It's a very hopeful story. And I'm going to come back in just a minute and talk about how this fits with some other things. But before we do that, let's look at verse 25. Because this sort of makes everything we've seen a little bit ambiguous. Verse 25 says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." Obviously, that's no endorsement of this period. That's a criticism of the period of the judges. It's really kind of a thesis statement. We saw that statement already made back in chapter 17, where the narrator of this book basically says, because there's no king, everybody's doing what is right in his own eyes, and it's obviously a very negative thing. What are we to make of that? What's the real problem in Israel that's being addressed?
They didn't honor God as king.
Okay. The first thing we have to say about this is the writer of Judges is not saying Israel's problems can be solved with a human monarch. Okay, there's two ways we know that. Okay, one is when they finally got a human monarch, did that solve all their problems? No, people still did what was right in their own eyes in many cases after Saul, after David, after Solomon. No matter how righteous the king was, it didn't matter. Israel still fell into sin. Okay, so this is not talking about how, if you just get your politics right, you can fix all your social problems. This is not a promise of salvation through politics. In fact, it's really just the opposite of that. Okay, because remember, the real key to this and the real turning point in the book is back in the days of Gideon. Okay, when Gideon, with his 300 men, remember God whittled down his army to a very small size, and then he delivers them from the Midianites. They're all about to starve to death, and Gideon comes to their rescue and delivers them. And they say to Gideon, "You be our king. You and your son can rule over us." And what does Gideon say back in chapter 8? He says, "I'm not going to be your king, and my son's not going to be your king. You have
God as your king.
Yahweh as your king. Yeah, the Lord is your king. Him you should serve." So the problem here is not a political problem in the sense if they just had a monarchy, if they just had a centralized government, that could fix everything that's wrong. The problem is Yahweh is their king, and nobody will acknowledge him as king. Okay? They've got a king. The Lord is their king. The reason everybody's doing what is right in his own eyes, the reason there's no functional king in Israel is because they have rejected Yahweh's kingship over them. Okay? And when a people rejects Yahweh's king, you know, Yahweh's kingship, what happens? They start to circle the drain. Okay? It's disastrous. Okay? To turn away from the living God, to serve other gods, to turn away from Yahweh as your king, to find another king, a substitute, to become your own king. When it says everyone's doing what is right in his own eyes, that's really what it's saying. Everybody's practicing autonomy. Everybody's being his own king. Okay? Everybody's defining reality for himself. Okay? If you recognize Yahweh as king, you're not going to do that, obviously. So that's fundamental to this, okay? So it's really ironic when it says there was no king in Israel. There is a king. Yahweh is his name. Him you should serve, okay? But there's something else, and we saw this, so if you weren't here, you're going to just have to, you can go back and look at the earlier chapters and see how this gets developed. But what you have in these final chapters is, it's not really a political failure that is highlighted here. It's actually a liturgical failure. It's a failure of the church more than it's a failure of the state. And the reason we know that is because from basically this ending that you have, which is out of chronological order, so it's obviously there to explain the entire book, chapter 17 to 21. These things all actually happened much earlier in the period of the judges, but they're put here to explain the entire period of the judges and why Israel could never get it right during this period of history, and it's this: their priests are unfaithful. As the priests, so the people. Okay? And because the priests have been unfaithful, the people have become corrupt. And so what you have towards the end here are stories that mostly highlight the failures of their priests, including the failure of this priest to protect his concubine. At first, he does the right thing, pursuing her when she runs away from him. Okay, and he pursues her, and he clearly loves her and wants to take care of her and bring her back into his house. But then on that fateful night in Gibeah, when he shoves her out the door and gives her over to the men of the city, and she's raped and murdered, and the next morning, as she's lying on the threshold of the door, he says, "Get up, let's go," and then finds out that she's dead. He has been like Adam in the garden. Adam in the garden should have protected his bride from the serpent. He did not do it, and that's the fall. This priest should have protected his bride from the satanic, serpentine, sodomite mob at the front at the front door of the house where he's staying. He doesn't do it. He hands his bride over to the serpent, and she's destroyed. Okay? That, of course, think of this in terms of the symbolism. You have the priest and you have the bride. Okay? The priest, you know, the judges and priests and kings are always Messiah figures, Christ figures. The bride or the mother is always a church figure. Okay, that's just the way Old Testament stories work. Those are the basic archetypes. Okay, this is a sign that the priests are not protecting the bride. The priests are not protecting the people, the bride of Yahweh, Israel, the way that they should. And that is the root of their problem. It's a failure of the priests. It's a failure of their pastors to lead them in faithful worship and to rightly represent Yahweh to the people as a faithful, protective husband, and to lead the people in worship of Yahweh and to teach them the ways of Yahweh so that they can submit to Yahweh as their king. As the priests, so the people. The priests are corrupt. The priests are not teaching them about Yahweh's kingship. And so what do you have? Social chaos, cultural chaos. Everybody is a king to himself. Everyone's doing what is right in his own eyes. That's what's being highlighted in these final chapters. And there's a lesson there for us, which we've talked about a little bit as we go. This means that if we feel like we live in a culture where the kingship of Jesus has been rejected and everybody is doing what is right in his own eyes, what's the answer to that? You're not going to fix it politically, okay? You're not going to fix it through the state. It's the church as a city set on a hill, the church as salt and light. Okay, it's the church where Yahweh's kingship is supposed to be faithfully represented and faithfully taught. That's how you're going to go about fixing things. Okay, when everybody's doing what is right in his own eyes, what's the solution? You know, how did we get there and what's the solution to that? Well, it's just like what Jesus says. When the salt loses its saltiness, it just gets trampled underfoot. When a church fails to represent and teach the kingship of Jesus and live out the kingship of Jesus as an example to the nation, as an example to the culture, yes, things fall apart. That's the way that it is. And so I think sometimes Christians are very quick, like when we see problems in the culture, to want to point the finger and say, aha, it's those progressives, it's those liberals, it's those Democrats, it's those Republicans, what have you. Well, the reality is, yes, okay, that's true. Or someone that's popular now says the Jews, okay? You know, you pick out a scapegoat and you say it's their fault, okay? But the reality is, non-Christians are going to do non-Christian things. Unbelievers are going to do unbeliever-type things, okay? The world is going to be the world, okay? The world is going to do what the world does. But if the world's not being changed, if the world's not being challenged and called to repentance, if there's no preservative, there's no salt at work in the culture to preserve righteousness, if there's no light shining into the darkness, whose fault is that? It's the fault of the salt. It's the fault of the light. It's the fault of the people of God. There's a very real sense in which the church, as the heavenly city, has to take responsibility for the state of the earthly city. And not just point fingers and blame sinners for sinning, but actually recognize we're the ones who have the power to do something about it if we will live faithfully, if we will worship faithfully, if we will live under the authority of King Jesus, proclaim the authority of King Jesus, implement the authority of King Jesus in our own lives, that will make a difference. That's what brings about a change. That's what Israel was not doing. Their priests weren't doing it, and so nobody in the nation was doing it, okay? Let me stop there. There's a few other things I want to highlight here, but let me stop there. Questions, comments, thoughts on this?
We don't get any commentary on the vow about like not giving their lives. And so in a sense, it kind of works out in the end, but they weren't supposed to marry the Canaanites, and so they knew that. So I was curious, was it wrong to make that vow? Or is there any... I don't know, from what I got, there wasn't any additional commentary, but...
Yeah. There's no commentary in the text on it. I would say, no, they were not wrong to make that vow. No more than they were wrong to go to war with Benjamin in the first place. Like, I would say withholding their wives from Benjamin was far lesser of a sanction against Benjamin than going to war with them. That's the greater sanction. So if the greater sanction was justified, the lesser sanction would be too. And I think what you see is a kind of, it's kind of like when Solomon, at the very beginning of Solomon's reign, you know, you've got two women who come before him with one baby, and they're fighting over this baby. One of the women has smothered her baby in the night. She took the other woman's baby. And so now you've got these two women fighting over one baby. And Solomon has to figure out how to basically pass judgment in this situation. You've heard me teach on this before, some of you. There's no verse you can go to in the Torah that says, okay, when two women are fighting over one baby, this is what you do. Okay, Moses didn't give a law about that. Okay, so what does it take to solve that? You can't solve it with law. You need wisdom. Okay, wisdom fills in the gaps that law doesn't address. Okay, it takes the principles of the law and the principles of reality, the way God has built the world to work, and wisdom solves problems accordingly. Okay, so wisdom knows what to do when there's no chapter and verse to tell you. Okay, so Solomon, because he understands human nature and because he understands maternal nature in particular, He basically comes up with a solution that will reveal the true mother of the baby. He says, chop it in half. You cut the baby in half, knowing that this will reveal the true mother. And that's what happens. Okay, you've got a similar kind of thing here. Okay, they have said, we're not going to give our own daughters to marry the men of Benjamin, but the men of Benjamin need wives. So how can we get them? And they devise this sort of clever workaround. Okay, and I do think it's a you could say a sort of savvy, shrewd workaround to solve the problem. Okay, again, not a model to use in day-to-day life by any means. Okay, this story is not intended to be prescriptive in that kind of way. There's not really anything here to imitate. It's just to learn from and see what God did at this stage in history and why these things happened and how God was faithful to his people in the midst of a very dark and difficult situation. And so that's what happens here.
I've got a question on the vows as well. It seems kind of harsh when they say, you know, oh, these guys from, where was it? Jabesh Gilead didn't come help us kill the Benjamites, so now we're going to, like, literally wipe them out. I don't know, it just seems very, we're not just going to kill the guys, we're going to kill the women and children too. It seems very harsh.
It does.
How is that called for?
Well,
the reaction seems extreme.
The whole human race was consigned to hell because Adam and Eve ate a piece of fruit. Sin is infinitely heinous because sin is always against an infinitely righteous, infinitely holy, infinitely worthy God.
Yeah.
And that's why only the death of Jesus, an infinitely worthy sacrifice, could deal with sin. So it is true, it might look like this punishment is too harsh on Jabesh Gilead. why would they're, and we're not even told why they were apathetic about it. If you look at a map, I mean, they had good ways to travel. You can make all kinds of excuses for them. But the reality is, all sin deserves death and damnation. All sin deserves eternal death and hell. And so the fact that their sin is judged in this particular way is not unjust. My guess is, by not joining in the war against the Benjamites, they really were implicitly siding with them.
Yeah.
Their sympathies were misplaced. And so they get put in the same category. They reveal their true heart as also being spiritual Canaanites.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
They reveal themselves as being spiritually in the same place as the tribe of Benjamin.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they get the same treatment, basically. There's a lot of things, especially in, throughout the book of Judges, I think we've seen this, but especially in these closing chapters, a lot of details. You read these stories, and you have a lot of questions, and the text does not answer all of our questions, and that's just a reality. And I don't know if that's part of God saying, "Hey, it belongs to kings to search out a matter," as Proverbs says. So search it out. Try your best to figure it out. And as you meditate on these things, you have an opportunity to grow in wisdom. That may be part of it. There may be other reasons why certain details get omitted that would answer really big and obvious questions we have about these stories. I don't know why the stories are told exactly why they're told, but we're given what we're given. The Holy Spirit has inspired the text the way he has for a particular reason, and we've got to wrestle with what's there. And in some cases, we might think, "Oh, with just a couple more pieces of information, everything would click into place." But we're not given that, so we've got to kind of just figure it out.
It's interesting how far removed we are from that time period and the customs, and like there's so many missing pieces that make it kind of hard for us to even grasp some of the narrative.
So many missing pieces, and yet also we see the exact same things in our own day. Casting off the kingship of Yahweh, the kingship of Jesus. Everybody does what is right in his own eyes. As the church goes, so the culture goes. I mean, the people in the town of Gibeah who come banging on his door, I mean, that's basically just an ancient pride parade is really what it is. It's a bunch of sexual perverts who want to carry out their perversion in public. We see the exact same thing all the time. We've got a whole month of the year dedicated to it. So yeah, I mean, we are very far removed from it. But it's also very relevant. It's absolutely relevant. Let me make a couple closing points here in the time we have left. Cutting up the woman and sending out the parts, as happens in the previous chapter, you can think of that. You might think of. I think the way to understand that is basically like a maledictory oath or a self-maledictory oath. Think of Genesis chapter 15, where God has Abraham cut up the pieces. And Abraham is scared to death because he thinks he's going to have to walk behind the pieces. And God's going to say, "Look, unless you make the promises of the covenant come true, you're going to be cut to pieces." That's how people would have understood it in the ancient world. And then Yahweh himself passes through the pieces. So God says, "Look, I will be dismembered. I will be chopped up into pieces. I will be put to death if that's what it takes for me to keep my covenant with you." And of course, that gets fulfilled on the cross where Jesus is put to death to fulfill the covenant. Okay, so... but anytime you have a cutting up of pieces and this kind of thing, I mean, that's what it is. It's some kind of self-maledictory covenant-making ceremony. So when those pieces are sent out to the nation, it's basically saying, "We're a covenant nation. We're a covenant people. You have an obligation to come and avenge the death of my bride. The death of my wife must be avenged. What the Benjamites have done must be dealt with in Israel. And if you don't respond... may you too be cut into pieces." Okay, that's Jabesh Gilead. Okay, that I think is what is happening there. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think Jabesh Gilead receives the judgment it does. But this is what's interesting. Okay, fast forward into 1 Samuel. Okay, I preached on this a while back, and I didn't get into all these details because it would have taken too much explanation. But there's a similar story in 1 Samuel chapter 11 that involves Jabesh Gilead. In 1 Samuel chapter 11, the Ammonites, led by Nahash, okay, his name means serpent, he invades the promised land, and he takes over the Israelite city of Jabesh-Gilead. So Ammonites, basically they're Canaanites, have come back into the land of promise and have taken over a city in the land of promise. They've taken over Jabesh-Gilead. And Saul summons the people of Israel to fight. And you know how he does it? He takes an oxen and he cuts it up into pieces and he sends the pieces out to the different tribes of Israel. Okay? It's the same kind of procedure, but this time with a sacrificial animal. And it's basically a way of saying, Saul, this is Saul. Saul's not even fully coronated yet as king, but he's taken on this leadership role in the nation. He cuts up the ox, he sends out the pieces, and he says, look, I am summoning you to come fight against the Ammonites, to come fight against the serpent that has invaded the garden, and to rescue Jabesh-Gilead from the serpent, from Nahash and the Ammonites. And if you don't, you will be cut to pieces just like this ox. And that's what they do. The people come and gather with Saul, and Saul leads them into battle, and they rescue and restore the town of Jabesh-Gilead. Now, this is what's interesting. What tribe is Saul from?
Benjamin.
And we've just been dealing with stories that deal with the tribe of Benjamin at the end of Judges. I'll get a little more technical here. What town was Saul from? In 1 Samuel chapter 11, or 1 Samuel chapter 10, we learn this. What town was he from?
Was it Gibeah?
He's from the town of Gibeah. Saul of Gibeah, the Benjamite. Okay, Gibeah, where the concubine was cut, was raped and murdered. Okay, that's Saul's hometown. Okay, now, that happened centuries earlier. Okay, but think about this. The Levite's concubine was raped and murdered in Gibeah. That is Saul's hometown. If Saul is from Jabesh-Gibeah, who does he descend from? He's a Benjamite. Two-thirds, okay, of the 600, 400 of the men of Benjamin, when their tribe got whittled down to 600 men, 400 of them married women from Jabesh-Gilead. Okay, two-thirds of the Benjamites in Saul's day were descendants of those women who were from Jabesh-Gilead. My guess is Saul was probably among them, but even if he wasn't, he had a vested interest in Jabesh-Gilead. Gibeah is his hometown, but Jabesh-Gilead is probably where his great-great-great-grandmother is from. Okay, she was probably one of those women who was spared. Okay, I mean, that's the odds favor that. Two-thirds, okay, four out of six, two-thirds of the tribe of Benjamin descended from those women. That is a reason why Saul would want to go to war to rescue and protect Jabesh-Gilead. And this is what's interesting. We can go one step further. Saul rescues Jabesh-Gilead from Nahash and the Ammonites. When Saul dies, the men of Jabesh-Gilead basically repay the favor with their own honor. Remember how Saul dies? Well, I haven't gotten to this in my preaching yet, but remember how Saul dies? It's at the hand of the Philistines. Saul and his three sons die at the hand of the Philistines. And what do the Philistines do with Saul and his sons' corpses?
Hang them up on the wall.
They take them and they hang them up to dishonor them, to desecrate them. And you know what happens from there? Men of Jabesh-Gilead go and rescue those corpses and bring them back to Israel so that Saul and his sons can be given a proper, fitting, and honorable burial. Okay? All these loose ends, that's one of those places where you just tie the knot. Okay? Just tie it off right there. All these loose ends, it all wraps together right there, okay? This Gibeah, Jabesh-Gilead, Saul, Benjamin, all of it, it's all tied together right there. So you kind of get a sense for how the Bible interconnects. One last thing I'll mention is this. There's a lot of other stuff here that's interesting. The high priest during the time when all this was taking place is a man named Phinehas. We learn that in chapter 20, verse 28. You've got Phinehas, who is the son of Eleazar and the grandson of Aaron. That's how we know that these stories at the end of the book took place chronologically much earlier. So the book of Judges from chapter 1 to chapter 16 is basically chronological. Chapter 17 to 21 take you back to the beginning of this era. and basically give you stories that explain why the whole era was such a mess. Okay, now Phineas, it's interesting. Phineas was a faithful priest. He was born right about the time of the Exodus. I think he's born in Exodus chapter 6. So right about, and he's got an Egyptian name. Phineas is an Egyptian name. In Numbers chapter 25, Balaam, who is a false prophet, tells other nations to use sexual immorality to weaken Israel. And so the men of Israel fall into sexual sin with pagan women. And anybody remember what Phineas does in Numbers chapter 25? Some of those kind of gory stories, okay, but...
Sex.
Yeah, there's an Israelite man and a Midianite woman who are fornicating, and he takes a spear and just puts it through both of them. He executes them for their sexual sin on the spot, okay? Phineas didn't mess around. And because of that, he is rewarded with a permanent priesthood in his family, okay? Psalm 106 says, by this act, it basically says, because of this act, he was declared righteous. Okay, it's an interesting passage because the same language is used of Abraham for his faith. Abraham believed God and was credited to him as righteousness. Phineas executed some fornicators and it was credited to him as righteousness. It's the same formula. And he's rewarded with a permanent priesthood in his family. His line will now be the priestly line. Okay, so when you think about what it means to be a pastor, okay, what it means to be a priest basically, because it's the same thing basically, okay. Priestly work, pastoral work is warfare. And Phineas is a good model of that. He shows us that. In 1 Chronicles chapter 9, we find that his original job was to be a gatekeeper of the tabernacle, okay, to be one of the armed guards who kept invaders out of the tabernacle. Okay, you think about, you know, the tabernacle as a new Eden. Adam should have guarded the tabernacle, the Garden of Eden from the serpent. Phineas and other men like him will guard the tabernacle. They are the gatekeepers. They are the protectors of the house of God. And so they would keep the house of God holy and its furnishings protected. In Numbers chapter 31, when the Israelites are going to go to war with the Midianites, Phineas leads the way. So sometimes you hear me talk about how worship is warfare. Okay, well, there's a lot of examples of this in the Old Testament. Well, here's one of them. They've got a priest who's leading the way into battle, okay? In like 1 Chronicles 20, you've got a choir that leads the people into battle, but it's the same kind of thing, okay? The priest is leading the people into battle, and he's taking with him the ark and the trumpets as they're going to fight the Midianites, okay? So Phineas was, obviously he was a great warrior priest, and he was a man who knew how to get things done, and he had a great zeal for the Lord, and his zeal was recognized and rewarded. And you see that again and again. So Phineas is a faithful priest, but it's clear that the other priests around him are not following his example. The other priests of Israel in this era are not following his example. When you get to the end of the book of Joshua, we find that he was the high priest. But the other priests did not follow his example. And I think that's important to recognize as well. You have a man who stood out as godly among his generation. Others would not imitate him. And that's part of what led into this whole mess that Israel was in. And then one last thing I'll say, if we had more time, I'd say a little bit more about this. But we always want to look for how these kinds of stories point us to Jesus ultimately, because we know the whole Bible is about Jesus. Go back to how this chapter ends. Every man does what is right in his own eyes because there was no king in Israel. I already made the point that just having a king is not going to be enough. Okay, when they get Saul as their king, that's clearly not enough. That doesn't fix the problem of sin in Israel. You've still got people doing what is right in their own eyes. When they get a better king, a king after God's own heart in David, that doesn't fix the problem. When they get the wisest possible king, Solomon, that doesn't fix the problem. There's only one king who can fix the problem. And that's King Jesus, who will perfectly represent Yahweh's rule to the people because he is Yahweh. He is Yahweh in the flesh. And so when this book leaves Israel, in a sense, longing for a king, sure, you could say there's a longing for a human king. And there may have been some expectation that that would make things better, but ultimately they need a more than human king. They need Yahweh himself in the flesh to be their king. And that's what they get in Jesus. And I think that's ultimately what Judges points us to. When we study the different judges, we saw how really every single judge in his own way is a Christ figure. Every single judge in some way points us to Jesus. And especially in the second half of the book, when you see the judges failing, or when the death of the judges is recorded, it's like so-and-so judged for 20 years and then he died. So-and-so judged for 20 years and then he died. Okay? Well, the judges keep dying. They need a judge who's not going to die. Or maybe we could say a judge who's going to come back from the dead and act as a super judge over Israel. And that's what they get in Jesus. He is the greater judge. He is the greater king. He's the one who's going to rule over God's Israel perfectly, faithfully. He's the one who's going to rule over God's Israel in perfect wisdom and bring his people into subjection to his rule. He's going to make us willing by his grace to obey him. And that's, I think, the hope that this book gives us. Okay, we've got a couple minutes. Questions, comments, or thoughts on any of that? The book of Judges is, it's a lot. It's a lot to take in, for sure. So I think what we're going to do next is study the book of Hebrews. That's kind of my plan at this point. I've been thinking about maybe doing the book of Ruth because it's really short and it kind of fits with Judges really well. But the next big study that we will get into is the book of Hebrews. So we'll get started on that sometime soon. Guys, thank you all for coming. Brad, you want to close us in prayer?
God, thank you.